everyone. Nam Om Myoho Renge Kyo. Thanks for being here with me today. Get settled in here. Okay, we're going to continue with a letter to the brothers. Actually, is this letter to the brothers? I've been reading so many different things, I forget what I'm reading. I thought this was letter to Horen. That's right. We finished the letter to the brothers. So this is the letter to the lay monk. And we were talking about Ilung and his dream about transcribing the Lotus Sutra, right? So, as we continue into this, I don't know if this is a challenge for you or what to call this exactly. I have a suggestion. If you feel like your practice is waning a little bit, or you're just not motivated, you're finding hard to motivate, or you're just wanting to understand the sutra more deeply, just engage your practice, or if you're doing just fine and riding along, I want to suggest something to you that I think is a really essential practice within our Buddhist practice that very, very few Buddhists actually do. I know, yet another thing, right? We chant with mandala, with Guhanzon. And we do these things and we study. And sometimes, even though that sounds like quite a few things, keeping up the altar and chanting and Gohanzon and all that, it can become rote. And I want to remind you that in many sutras, but certainly throughout the Lotus Sutra, the exhortation to practice is to embrace, certainly, read, which we do, recite, Gongyo. But what about copy? Do any of you write the sutra down? And so this is a suggestion I want to make to you. I'm not telling you to copy the entire Lotus Sutra, although why not? But something in our modern society that I think, you know, I grew up in the 70s, and throughout the 70s and even into the 80s, I think today it's morphed into something else, but we used to write down positive affirmations. Some of you may be old enough to remember that. Those of you that aren't, I'm sure you know somebody or have heard of it. I'm not suggesting that you write down a passage and then tape it on your mirror and put it on your fridge. And, you know, we used to do that. But I think that something that's very useful is that when you, even in listening to these videos, if there's just one, maybe there's a sentence or a short or a quote or maybe a paragraph, whatever. Perhaps something yet you hear me explain and for some reason has a renewed meaning for you. Pause the video, pause the podcast, pause your reading if you're doing it on your own, and take time to transcribe, write it down word for word. And maybe what you're writing down is not only part of the Gosho or part of the sutra that's being quoted, but maybe after it you put down whatever insight that you got hearing me talk about it. Just write it down. Put it in your journal. Put it in a binder that's, you know, maybe favorite quotes or something. You don't have to post it anywhere. The physical, mental, multi-sense act of reading, recalling, transcribing, reading with your eyes, your body, instantiating these things. I am saying to you that this act of transposition will act upon your mind differently than simply listening to me or simply reading it. You will inculcate it into your being. And it will become, even if not literal, even if not during moments of the day, oh, that quote, it will influence. You'll be training your mind, which is what we're doing in Buddhism, right? But this is a very important tool. Transcription is a very cellular kind of way to learn, to teach oneself, especially if it's a moment of insight. And that's what I want you to grab. When something piques your interest, or maybe it's something that throws you and you're not sure what it means yet, write that down too. I'm telling you, it will launch your practice. Okay? You will chant differently. You will think differently. You will see Gohonzon differently. So just make it a little habit. You don't have to transcribe the whole thing, but just when those moments of either when you're confounded about something, or certainly when you have an insight about something, write it down nice and clearly so that if you run into it 6 months from now and go, what was that scribble about? You can read it and go, oh, and it'll hit you. That's a very powerful way to study and practice this Buddhism. Okay? So while we're in the midst of Ilung here and his troubles, I think you'll see now hints in this story about the power of transcription. All right, so let's get into it. Starting from where we left off, Ilung, filled with awe, swore an oath, saying, quote, from this day forth, I will never transcribe so much as a single character of the non-Buddhist scriptures, end quote. It was similar to the oath taken when Bodhisattva Vasubandhu vowed never again to recite Hinayana Sutras, or when Nichiren pledged that he would never recite the name of Amida Buddha, the Nembutsu. After Ilung awakened from his dream, he reported to the ruler what had happened. The ruler then issued a proclamation saying, quote, the Buddhist ceremony that I undertook is hereby completed. You will write a paper or a meditation describing the events that have taken place, end quote. Ilung did as he was instructed. As a result, people in China and Japan came to take resolve and conviction in the Lotus Sutra. These events are described in the Chinese work entitled The Lotus Sutra and Its Traditions. So again, the scholarship of Nichiren, right? He can quote these many, many thousands of dialogues, not only within the teachings, but outside the teachings of the Lotus Sutra. It's a fabulous tool of instruction when you have such a depth of knowledge, right? So he continues, what I have said here pertains to the blessings that derive from transcribing the sutra. For those who carry out one or another of the five practices, the act of transcribing the sutra produces the lowest grade of blessings. How much more immeasurable, then, are the blessings to be won by reading or reciting the sutra? So he's putting them in order, but he's not discounting it entirely. He's simply saying that when you actualize your Buddha nature, chanting to your mandala, the Gohonzon, that's your maximal invocation of your awakening, of course. So writing and transcribing does not replace that, right? And reading through it is how you instruct yourself and deepen your resolve to chant to Gohonzon. But transcribing that is yet another act that's very foundational for your depth of confidence and knowledge in what it is you are reading and practicing. Follow? He goes on. As to the blessings derived by you, who as chief mourner have recited the verse section of the lifespan chapter every morning for a period of 13 years, they can only be understood and shared between Buddhas. In other words, implying that his dedication to Gangyo every morning, even if his inspiration is his deceased father, he has for himself awakened his Buddha nature. The Lotus Sutra, he continues, represents the bone and marrow of all the sacred teachings of the Buddha's lifetime, and the verse section of the lifespan chapter represents the heart of the 28 chapters of the sutra. The various Buddhas of the three existences look upon the lifespan chapter as their very life, and the Bodhisattvas of the 10 directions likewise regard the chapter's verse section as their eyes. But it is not for me to describe the blessings derived from the verse section of the lifespan chapter. Rather, I refer to the subsequent distinctions and benefits chapter, which elaborates on them. It says that those who became Buddhas after hearing the above verse section are equal in number to the particles of dust in a minor world system or major world system. Moreover, those who attained enlightenment by listening to the six chapters from the Medicine King chapter on are merely those who had remained unenlightened after gaining blessings from the verse section of the lifespan chapter. And in the 40 volumes of the Nirvana Sutra, the Buddha once more explained the blessings to be derived from the verse section to the 52 types of beings who were gathered there. So it becomes clear that the great bodhisattvas, heavenly beings and others, numerous as the dust particles of the lands of the 10 directions, who gathered together like clouds on the occasion of the Buddha's preaching of the Flower Garland Sutra at the Palace of the Enlightenment, the various sages who attended on the occasions of his preaching of the Great Collection and Larger Wisdom Sutras, and the 1,200 and more honored ones who listened to the Mahavacharana Sutra and the Diamond Crown Sutra, it becomes clear that sometime in the past these people listened to the verse section of the lifespan chapter of the Lotus Sutra. But because their resolute mind and conviction was weak, they failed to attain enlightenment, even though incalculably long periods, major world system dust particle kalpas and numberless major world system dust particle kalpas passed by. However, when they encountered Shakyamuni Buddha, the blessings of the Lotus Sutra began to work for them, so that they were able to gain enlightenment through the sutras preached prior to the Lotus Sutra and did not have to wait until the assembly at Eagle Peak to do so. So once again, the order of the teachings is clear, right? And here it is a validation of a statement you've heard me say many times, is that the Lotus Sutra sits atop all of the provisional teachings. So although there's a lot to be gained by studying all of Buddhism, and that is our instruction, that is what we should do, we can't be derailed along the way and just decide we've learned enough. It isn't until we gain the wisdom of the Lotus Sutra and its penetrating ultimate methodology that all of this previous learning instantly develops our depth of knowledge and experience when we awaken our Buddha mind, so that it becomes an overwhelming cellular experience instead of a simply superficial one that we're not sure what to do with. But in any case, consequently, he goes on, the Buddhas throughout the 10 directions looked up to the verse section of the lifespan chapter as their teacher and attained Buddhahood. This verse section is like a father and mother to the people of the world. A person who embraces the lifespan chapter of the Lotus Sutra is sustaining the life of Buddhas. Of the Buddhas. Would any Buddha then abandon a person who embraces the very sutra through which that Buddha attained enlightenment? If any Buddha should abandon such a person, it would be as though he were abandoning himself, right? It's simply an illogical thing to do. Suppose there was a woman who had given birth to 3,000 outstanding warriors of the caliber of Tamura or Toshihito. Talk about a difficult practice. Would one choose to make an enemy of such a woman? Probably not. To do so would be like handing 3,000 generals over to the side of one's opponent, would it not? In the same way, anyone who would treat a person who embraces the verse section of the lifespan chapter as an enemy would be making an enemy of all the Buddhas of the three existences, because this is how the Buddhas attain their enlightenment. It's in the lifespan chapter of Myoho Renge Kyo, right? All the characters in which the Lotus Sutra is written represent living Buddhas, every character. But because we have the eyes of common mortals, we see them as characters. It is like the example of the Ganges River. Hungry spirits see the waters of the river as fire. Human beings see them as water, and heavenly beings see them as Amrita. The waters are the same in all cases, but each type of being sees them differently, according to the effects of its karma. So I've already talked about this, right? The word that I use is how we experience things, right? Like the fountain analogy, if you remember that video. As for the characters of the Lotus Sutra, a blind person cannot see them at all. A person with the eyes of a common mortal sees them as black in color. Persons of the two vehicles see them as the void. Bodhisattvas see various different colors in them, while a person whose seeds of Buddhahood have reached full maturity sees them as Buddhas. In other words, every character becomes an actualization of our Buddha mind, our Buddha nature. So the sutra states, quote, "If one can uphold this sutra, one will be upholding the body's Buddha's body, the Buddha's body." So what does that mean? The Buddha, again, a life condition, not a person. The body is Myoho Renge Kyo. It is the teaching of the actualization of Buddha within our samsaric existence. So body refers to the teachings, the entirety of the teachings, in that they allow us to invoke our innate Buddhahood, our Buddha-ness. Does that make sense? And Tendai said, quote, "The Lotus Sutra of the Wonderful Law, before which I bow my head, in its single case, with its 8 scrolls, 28 chapters, and 69,384 characters, is in each and every one of its characters the true Buddha who preaches the law for the benefit of living beings." So this is another way to see the teaching of the Lotus Sutra, is that the Myoho Renge Kyo is such the point of the teaching that the teaching itself, down to every syllable, is itself an expression of achieving that enlightenment, that awakening. So how powerful is it to transcribe that? Think about that for a moment. How precious are those characters, those words? And no wonder all of us gain insights in our own way from them, because our Buddha nature is built in. In light of all of this, we can say that each morning, when he recites the verse section of the lifespan chapter, the monk Horen is sending forth golden-hued characters from his mouth. These characters are 510 in number, and each character changes into a sun, and each sun changes into a Thus Come One Shakyamuni. They emit great beams of light that penetrate the earth and shine upon the three evil paths and the great citadel of the hell of incessant suffering, which is life, right? They also shine toward the east, west, north, south, and upward, ascending to the realm where there is neither thought nor no thought. They visit the realm where your departed father is dwelling, wherever it may be, and there hold discourse with him. So this is a way of visualizing a connection he's making with his deceased father, or more accurately, the karma, the energy that passed through all of his ancestors into him for him to combine and instantiate with his own. Follow the energetic path, the Nidana, throughout the time. Quote, who do you think we are, they say? We are the characters of the verse section of the lifespan chapter of the Lotus Sutra that your son Horen recites each morning. These characters will be your eyes, your ears, your feet, your hands. Thus do they earnestly converse with your father. And at that time, your departed father will say, quote, Horen is not my son, rather he is a good friend to me. And he will turn and pay respects in the direction of the Saha world, for what you are doing is an act of true filial devotion. We speak of upholding the Lotus Sutra, but although there is only one sutra, the manner in which we uphold it may vary from one period to the next. There may be times when a person literally rends his flesh and others it, and offers it to his teacher, and in this way attains Buddhahood. Or at other times a person may offer his body as a couch to his teacher, or as so much firewood. At yet other times a person may bear the blows of sticks and staves for the sake of the sutra, or may practice religious austerities to observe various precepts, and there may be times when even though a person does the things described above, he still does not attain Buddhahood. It depends upon the time, and it is not something fixed. So this refers to early teachings, right? Therefore, the great teacher Tendai declared, quote, the method chosen should be that which accords with the time. And the great teacher Chang'an said, quote, you should let your choices be fitting and never adhere solely to one or the other. So now Nichiren returns to a favorite a device of his, the question and answer form. Because he's aware, as he after the statements he just made, that lots of questions are going to pop up here. So he asks them, question, at what time should one offer one's body, and at what time should one observe the precepts? Answer, a person of wisdom is one who, understanding the time, spreads the teachings of the Lotus Sutra accordingly. This is his most important task. If a person's throat is dry, what he needs is water. He has no use for bows and arrows, weapons and sticks. If a person is naked, he wants a suit of clothes, but has no need for water. From one or two examples, you can guess the principle that applies in general. Suppose there is a great demon who is working to spread the teachings of the Lotus Sutra. In such a case, one should offer one's body as alms to the demon. There is no need to offer any other food or clothing, because the nature of demons, right? It's a really weird example, but... Or suppose there is an evil ruler who is bent upon destroying the teachings of the Lotus Sutra. In such a case, even at the cost of one's life, one must not obey him. It's like the dream he just talked about, Ilun, right? Prior to Ilun, his father. Anyway, in such a case, blah, blah, blah. And if there should be eminent monks who keep the precepts and practice religious austerities, and who appear to be spreading the teachings of the Lotus Sutra, but are in fact subverting them, you should perceive the truth of the matter and reprimand them. So this is this reformation theme of Nichiren all the time, and not just Nichiren, this has happened throughout the history of Buddhism. Nagarjuna, Vasubandhu, Tendai, Miaolo, Dengyo, Vimalakirti, it's throughout Buddhism. There's always a corrector. There's always a you know, as human beings, as samsaric beings, no matter how valuable the teaching, we constantly inculcate our own little desires and attachments into it, and it starts to push the correctness away, and it starts to become a teaching outside of Buddhism with the label of Buddhism on it. And then somebody comes along and go, whoa, 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 and pulls the reins back and says, all of that, that's not Buddhism. This is what comes from the sermons. This is what comes from the commentary. This is the correct practice. Stop doing that other crap, right? So Nichiren is in the history of Buddhism yet another reformer. Nichiren is uniquely placed in that his reformation gives us the ultimate simple tool to awaken our enlightenment. Doesn't require years of meditation and supplication or any of these things. It is the teaching of the Lotus Sutra, or Myoho Renge Kyo itself, is that invocation of our awakening. Now it's up to us to use that tool to inculcate a Buddha nature consistently, moment to moment, in our samsaric life. That's the key to a productive, well-lived life, which was the goal of Buddhism from the get-go. Okay. The Lotus Sutra says, quote, "We care nothing for our bodies or lives, but are anxious only for the unsurpassed way." That's an attitude, not a literal discarding. Because without this body, we wouldn't be able to practice Buddhism. So it's not literal, but it is a meaningful invocation of our dedication, a confirmation of our confidence and resolve. Okay. And the Nirvana Sutra states, quote, "It is like a royal envoy, dot, 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 would rather, even though it cost him his life, in the end, conceal none of the words of his ruler," end quote. The great teacher Chang'an commented on this, quote, "A royal envoy would rather, even though it cost him his life, in the end, concealed none of the words of his ruler, means that one's body is insignificant while the law is supreme. One should give one's life in order to propagate the law." So understand that that's not about immolation. It's not about burning your body up in the street. It's about using every cell of your human existence with the conviction and confidence and resolve to spread this teaching, to inculcate it into your life in each and every moment of that life. And by Bodhisattva way, help others arise to this resolution, this awakening. "Judging from outward appearances, at present I, Nichiren, am the most perverse man in all of Japan. Among 100, 1,000, 10,000, or 1,000,000 people of the four categories of believers in the 66 provinces and two outlying islands of our country, I am detested by the entire populace of both high and low station. In the 700 or more years since the teachings of Buddha were first introduced to Japan, there has never been anyone who was hated to such a degree because of the Lotus Sutra." Well, not because of the Lotus Sutra, but because of his adamant, resolute propagation of it, right? "I have never heard that such person existed in India or China, other than Shakyamuni himself, nor do I believe that they could have existed. Thus, I am the most perverse man in the entire land of Jambudvipa." So he's holding up his struggles of his life as an example to Horen. "Because of this, even my own kindred dare not visit me, to say nothing of those who are not related to me. They fear the authority of the government officials and regard with apprehension the sneers of the populace." And there's the real matter at hand. It's not that he is see, to say he's a perverse man is to indicate the social structure. He himself is not a perverse man, but in the society, authoritarian shogunate, samurai society that rules through authority and threat, Nichiren seems perverse because he shouldn't exist. He should be dead. He should be gone. And yet he persists. And his own relatives are afraid to visit him, not because of what Nichiren says and does, but because of the authoritarian government's attitude toward what he says and does. So it's important to understand that difference. "Persons who have been helped by me, not only in religious matters, but in secular affairs as well, fearful of the eyes of others and hoping thereby to put an end to the talk, make a show of condemning me, though I do not think they do so in their hearts. So that's interesting. And how contemporary is that, right? Don't we see that in our daily lives today? People are easily politically voiced in our society. And we see in social media people who prey on that and sway people's minds simply by manipulating their ideas, their social status and belonging. It's really kind of frightening when you think about it this way. Several times I have met with difficulties, and twice I have incurred the wrath of the government authorities. Not only have I myself suffered punishment, but some of those who are associated with me have had to suffer official punishment, have had their lands confiscated, have been dismissed from service by their lords, or have been abandoned by their parents and brothers. As a result of all this, I have been cast aside by those who followed me in the past, and at present I am without followers. In particular, in the case of the most recent instance of punishment from the government, it was certain that I would be executed, but instead, for some unknown reason, the government authorities banished me to the island of province of Sado. Among those sent to Sado, most die, few live. And after I had finally managed to reach my place of exile, I was looked upon as someone who had committed a crime worse than murder or treason. After leaving Kamakura for Sado, each day I seemed to face growing numbers of powerful enemies. The people I encountered were all advocates of the Nemutsu, and as I made my way through the fields and over the mountains, the sound of the grasses and trees by the wayside rustling in the wind, I supposed to be the attacks of my enemies. At last I reached the province of Sado. There, true to the nature of that northern land, I found the wind particularly strong in winter, the snows deep, the clothing thin, and food scarce. I well understood then how the mandarin orange tree, uprooted and transplanted to a different locale, can quite naturally turn into a triple-leaved orange tree. My dwelling was a dilapidated grass roof hut in the midst of a field thick with elulia and pampas grass, where corpses were buried. Rain leaked in, and the walls did not keep out the wind. Day and night, the only sound reaching my ears was the sighing of the wind by my pillow. Each morning, the sight of that met my eyes was the snow that buried the roads far and near. I felt as though I had passed through the realm of hungry spirits and fallen alive into one of the cold hells. I experienced the same thing as Su Wu, who was detained for 19 years in the land of the northern barbarians and ate snow to keep himself alive, or Li Ling, who dwelled for 6 years in a rocky cave, clothed in a coat of straw. Now, as it happens, the sentence of exile has been lifted. But I found that there was no safety for me in Kamakura, nor could I remain there for any length of time, and so beneath the pines and among these mountain rocks I have hidden my body and set my mind at peace. But except for having the earth itself to eat and the grass and trees to wear, I am cut off from all provisions of food and clothing. What feelings prompted you, I wonder, to come pushing through the wilderness to visit me in such a place? Have my departed father and mother perhaps taken possession of you? Or is this some blessing brought about by the world-honored one of great enlightenment? I cannot hold back my tears. Question. You pointed to the great earthquake of the Shoka era and the great comet of the Bunei era, and said that our country would face danger from revolt within an invasion from abroad because it failed to heed the Lotus Sutra. May I ask your reasons? First of all, I want to acknowledge that Nichiren hasn't talked in detail very often about his exile to Sado. There's quite a lot of information in this letter that he shares with Horen. He obviously treats Horen as a very dear friend and spirit in his life, Nichiren's life. He's getting older now, and he's finally returned from exile, but the government have turned so many people against him that he's looking for solace out in a barren area around Minobu. Kind of put himself in his own exile of the sorts, not unlike a topic I've talked about before, the samurai and Satori. When they retire, they go off in a mountain and they hermitize and contemplate their awakening, right? Their enlightenment. But they don't have the tool of Myoho-ren Geikyo, whereas Nichiren does. So when this young monk comes to find him, to check on him, to bring him supplies, and to report to him that he's been doing gangyo for his deceased father, and honoring Nichiren, really, Nichiren is moved to tears. Maybe he was even having a crisis of his own, wondering how he could proceed to propagate these teachings and the law at the face of such formidable opposition, right? So Horen is almost a lifeline. So he's very, very moved. So now, answer. Heavenly calamities and strange occurrences on earth such as these two are not to be found anywhere in the 3,000 or more volumes of non-Buddhist teachings or writings. The major comets or major earthquakes described in the three records, five canons, and records of the historian are comets with tails 1 or 2 feet in length, 10 or 20 feet, or perhaps 50 or 60 feet, but not one with a tail that stretches across the whole sky. The same applies for the magnitude of the earthquakes described therein. And if we examine the Buddhist scriptures, we find that during the entire period since the Buddha passed away, no such major portents as these have ever appeared. Even in India, when King Pushyamitra wiped out the teachings of Buddhism in the five regions of India, burned the temples and stupas in the 16 great states, and cut off the heads of monks and nuns, no such portents as these appeared. And Buddhism has a little bit of a bloody history, doesn't it? Likewise, in China, when the emperor of Huicheng era abolished over 4,600 temples and monasteries and forced 260,500 monks and nuns to return to secular life, there were no manifestations of this kind. In our own country, when the Buddhist teachings were introduced during the reign of Emperor Kimei, Moriya showed enmity toward Buddhism, and later monk Kiyomori burned the seven major temples of Nara. And the monks of Mount Hiei burned and destroyed Onjoji Temple. But even then, no such comet of such great size appeared. It seemed to me that it was essential for people to know that an even more portentous event was about to occur in this world of Jampadvipa. Therefore, I composed a work entitled On Establishing the Correct Teaching for the Peace of the Land, and presented it to His Lordship, the lay monk of Saimyoji. In that document, I stated, and here I surmise, quote, "This great portent, great earthquake, is a sign that our country is about to be destroyed by some other country. This will happen because the priests of the Zen, the Nembutsu, and other schools are attempting to destroy the Lotus Sutra." You see, it's not just that they're errant or erroneous teachings. It's that it's part of their goal to eliminate Myoho-ren Geikyo. Unless the heads of these monks are cut off and cast away at Hui Beach in Kamakura, the nation will surely be destroyed. Later, when the great comet of the Bunye era appeared, I had the proof of disaster in my very hand, and I became more convinced than ever of what was about to take place. On the 12th day of the 9th month in the year of Bunen era 1271, when I incurred the wrath of the authorities, I repeated my warning, saying, quote, I am the pillar of Japan. If you lose me, you lose the country, end quote. I knew that my advice was unlikely to be heeded at that time, but I wanted to give it anyway for future reference. Again, on the 8th day of the 4th month of the last year, 1274, when I had a meeting with Heino Simon Nojo, he asked when the Mongol forces would invade Japan. I replied that the sutra texts have no clear indication of the month and day, but that since the eyes of heaven were so filled with anger these days, it would surely be no later than the present year. People may ponder or wonder how I happen to know such things. I am a person of little worth, but I am working to spread the teachings of the Lotus Sutra. When the ruler and the ministers and the common people of a country show animosity toward the votary who propagates the Lotus Sutra, then the gods of earth and gods of heaven, who were present when the Lotus Sutra was preached and who took a vow to protect its votary, will respectively begin to tremble with anger and emit beams of light as threat to the nation. And if, in spite of all the remonstrance, the ruler and his ministers fail to heed the warnings, then in the end the gods will take possession of human beings and will cause revolt within the nation and attack from abroad. Once again, these are very colorful stories, and they're expedient means meant to teach life condition, mental exercises, ways of understanding the experience of samsara. And basically, he's not saying anything more magical than the fact that if you put out mistaken views and more than that, you actively fight correct views, there's going to be consequences. You're inculcating the consequences yourself because you know better. You really do. And what motivates people to do this kind of thing, certainly about the Lotus Sutra, but in any situation where they fight obvious truth or correctness, is fear. Fear, cowardice, and a craven desire for control, power, right? It's not life-affirming. It's really life-unaffirming. It's temporary gains, right? Question, what proof can you offer for these assertions? So again, Nichiren is going to go back to scholarship, right? Answer, a sutra says, because evil people are respected and favored and good people are subjected to punishment, the stars and constellations, along with the winds and rains, all fail to move in their proper seasons. In effect, heaven and earth are a mirror of the nation. And again, this goes to the Buddhist teachings of you are your environment is you. We, samsara, tend to see everything outside ourselves as other, as something either assisting us or working against us. This is the basis of all distorted views, religions, and political machinations, right? When we understand fully, deeply, that we are the world and the world is our expression in life, we have a completely different lens from which to observe the world and our own lives. So when he says heaven and earth are a mirror of the nation, this is what he's talking about. Heaven and earth aren't places so much as conditions, life conditions, right? From lofty to base, all our life conditions are a mirror of our own mental attitudes. In our state now, there are heavenly calamities and strange occurrences on earth. One should realize that the ruler of the state must be committing some error. The situation revealed as though in a mirror, so there is no disputing it. I mean, it doesn't originate outside of ourselves. If the ruler is guilty of minor errors only, then only minor calamities will be revealed in the heavenly mirror. But the fact that we are now witnessing major calamities must mean that the ruler is committing major errors, and the ruler is a figurehead of the population. So the Benevolent King Sutra speaks of innumerable types of minor disasters, 29 types of medium disasters, and 7 types of major disasters. One name for this sutra is Benevolent Kings, but another name is the Mirror of Heaven and Earth. And this sutra can be used as a, quote, mirror of heaven and earth, end quote, in which to catch a clear reflection of the nation's ruler. Moreover, the sutra states, quote, once the sages have departed, the 7 disasters are certain to arise, end quote. So what this means is the sages are the thought, the mental condition of the populace. And when that degrades, so does the conditions of the world they exist in, right? Socioeconomical collapse, political collapse, disease, famine, so on and so forth. One should understand from this that there is a great sage in this country of ours, and one should also understand that the ruler of their nation does not put resolve in the sage. Question: in earlier times when Buddhist temples were destroyed, why were there no omens such as we see at present? Answer: omens are large or small depending upon whether the errors that caused them are grave or minor. The omens that have appeared this time are greatly to be wondered at. They have appeared not just once or twice, not one merely on merely one or two occasions. Rather, they have become more and more frequent with passing of time. From this, you should understand that the errors being committed by the ruler of the nation are more serious than those committed by rulers in earlier times, and that it is a graver error for a ruler to persecute a sage than it is for him to kill many common people, or to kill many of his ministers, or to kill his parents. In Japan at present, the ruler, his ministers, and the common people are committing major offenses such as have not been known in India, China, or anywhere else in Jambudvipa in the 2,220 years or more since the passing of the Buddha. It is as though all the people throughout the worlds of the 10 directions who are guilty of committing any of the 5 cardinal sins were to be gathered together in a single spot. The monks of this country have all become possessed by the spirits of Devadatta and Kokalika. The ruler of the nation has become a reincarnation of King Ajatashatru or King Virudaka. And in the case of the ministers and the common people, it is as though someone gathered together evil people like the ministers Varshakara and Chandrakirti, or like Shunakshastra and Girika, and had them constitute the people of Japan. So you'll have to do your research to understand each of those, but I think you get the point, right? Where are we time-wise? Okay, need to wrap it up. I'll finish his response here and I'll stop at the next question. In ancient times, when there were 2 or 3 persons guilty of the 5 cardinal sins or of unfilial conduct, the ground where those people were standing split apart and they were swallowed up. But now the whole country is filled with such people. Therefore, the entire earth under Japan would have split apart in one instant and the whole country fall into the hell of incessant suffering. There would be no point in its simply opening up to swallow 1 or 2 persons. It is like the case of an aging person who pulls out a white hair here and there. When he becomes truly old, his whole head will turn white, and it is no longer any use trying to pull out the hairs one by one. The only thing to do then is to shave off all the hair in one stroke. So this is a time that requires a radical change in direction. And this is what Nichiren has been presenting to the ruling class ever since he started chanting Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. the remonstration, the Rishon Kukuran that he spoke, referred to earlier, was the beginning of great troubles for Nichiren. The government did not want to hear that they weren't practicing correctly, that they weren't ruling the country correctly from some lowly fisherman's son who happened to be an educated monk, right? Authoritarianism, it's so plain as day, and it's so simple, but deep consequences, right? So I hope you found some kind of, I don't know, insight, inspiration, even if just a fascination with some of these stories. Are kind of like watching a Kurosawa movie, aren't they? But it's very interesting because they're all illustrating the kinds of dramas that go on in our samsaric minds. And so they're useful in that way. Even in the way that they take us away a little bit and we forget, oh yeah, I'm learning or I'm teaching myself Buddhism, and you're off in a foreign land having these battles. But it's important to remember even that, how easily we're influenced by stories. There's a lot to be gained from these stories, but they can also, if our attitude is incorrect, if we don't remember why we're and what insights we're looking for in these stories, we can get taken away and forget what we're doing. So as a reminder, remember transcribing. If this thought had something in it, whether you'll get your own insights from these videos, as you will all of your study. Those are your valuable insights. Write them down. Just write them down. You may never read them again, but you know, get yourself a little notebook. If you're someone who has a diary or a journal, you know where to put it. If you've never done that before, just get a pad, anything where you can look at the words you're writing down, remember them, think about them, what they mean as you're writing them down. You may even put, you know, a short bulleted list underneath it of the things it brought up. Some way, create this physical created reminder to yourself of your insight, because next week you won't remember it. And just seeing it again, just randomly looking at it and go, oh yeah, you may be surprised at how it simply applies to something you're struggling with in that moment. Transcription is so valuable a tool, along with your recitation, right, and study. So I encourage you to do that. Let me know in the comments if it works for you, if you've had any experiences with that. And until, I guess this is part 3, so until part 4, stay healthy, keep your practice strong. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. I'm here for you, and I appreciate you being here for me. Take care.